打磨闭门会，解读加原声。美联储政策路径研判，亚洲非 AI 经济复苏，新兴市场配置策略及中国大模型行业深度展望。闭门会解读。一、美联储政策展望。一、加息判断。基准预期2026年。美联储不加息，不降息。2027年开启宽松。通胀持续下行，核心商品。住房通胀走弱，关税退坡将持续带来通缩压力。非农就业三个月均值逼近5万盈亏平衡点。劳动力市场不再提供强劲通胀压力。数据层面不支持年内加息。二、市场分歧根源，市场仍定价一定加息概率。核心矛盾在于均衡利率、中性利率。缺乏清晰官方沟通。团队判断美国中性利率约 3%, 而非 3.5% 以上。若美联储上调对中性利率的评估，将重启加息逻辑。三、关键观察节点，8月27日捷克。逊霍尔年会。美联储主席讲话有望明确政策框架，锚定市场对中性利率的预期。9月议息会议，点阵图。同时，会前还有 CPI、非农两份关键数据。四、日元干预点评。美日联合日元干预短期提振汇率，但历史上汇率干预效果难以持续。中长期日元走势取决于美日利差变化，干预属于美国财政部操作，美联储仅承担交易执行职能，不改变美联储货币政策。二、亚洲经济 AI 之外存在独立复苏主线，市场高度聚焦 AI 产业链，但亚洲非 AI 经济板块复苏具备独立性。三大验证信号。一、非科技出口强势，剔除 AI 半导体相关品类后，亚洲非 AI 出口同比增速约 17%， 2024年10月以来年化增速达 25%， 增长广泛扩散。二、进口全面改善，非 AI 相关资本品、中间品、消费品进口同步回暖，不再仅依靠资本设备拉动。三、资本开支不单纯由 AI 驱动，亚洲能源资本开支规模庞大，仅约 30% 至 35% 增量由 AI 需求带动。工业、国防等大额资本开支独立于 AI， 形成资本开支超级周期。四、消费分化格局。日韩、印度非科技出口与资本开支带动就业改善，薪资转正，居民消费持续修复。中国非科技出口回暖时间尚短，有望逐步改善。非大宗商品行业企业盈利与薪资带动消费温和修复，但人口地产拖累下消费难以强劲反弹。三、亚洲新兴市场股市观点。一、整体偏好，上调韩国至超配，持续看好日本、新加坡、泰国、中国、印度。印尼企业盈利预期仍面临下行压力。二、韩国市场核心逻辑，市场整体远期 RO 超 30%， 估值长期处于极低区间。七月下跌主要来自杠杆资金被动平仓，并非基本面恶化。板块覆盖 AI 资本开支、工业设备、国防、能源多条主线，风险收益比突出。三、市场对比，台湾股市估值回报率贴近美股，和 AI 周期高度绑定，相比之下当前韩国市场投资机会更显著。四、行业配置主线，优先资本开支链、半导体、存储、科技硬件、工业资本品、原材料、能源，规避汽车、可选消费、必须消费品、电商，多数 IT 服务。仅在超配区域看好本地金融板块，不建议大规模轮动布局中国、印度、印尼市场。四、中国大模型 LLM 行业研判，从价格战走向技术驱动变现。 行业将摆脱恶性价格竞争。三大趋势抬升行业壁垒，改善盈利。一、定价回归理性，中美模型 API 价差持续收窄，头部低价厂商启动涨价，持续低价会侵蚀研发资金，难以维持前沿模型迭代能力，价格战不具备可持续性。二、开源模型商业模式升级，开源不等于免费，厂商收紧开源协议，通过和云厂商分成，打开第三方部署变现空间，开源不会挤压算力需求，更低门槛刺激整体使用量提升，开源与闭源模型长期共存。三、模型参数规模持续上行，2-3万亿参数，逐步成为国内前沿模型标配，大模型拉高资金、算力、工程技术门槛，加速行业出清，龙头壁垒扩大。重点标的简要观点：质朴 AI 短期排名波动被市场过度定价，商业化飞轮持续成型，上调目标价。10月新一代大模型为关键催化， Minimax 3季度3万亿参数大模型是核心看点，视频生成业务打造第二增长曲线，维持超配，下调目标价。互联网大厂 BAT 机会，云厂商是开源大模型普及的核心受益者，企业出于数据安全倾向，依托云平台部署。第三方开源模型，云厂商可与大模型企业分成，持续拉动云计算收入提速。五、问答补充关键观点。一、 AI 对美国通胀与增长影响，通胀影响十分有限， AI 推高芯片成本仅体现在 PPI 上游，难以向下游传导，计算机硬件在美国居民消费篮子占比极低，仅带来数个基点通胀压力，远小于关税退坡的通缩影响。增长 AI 资本开支显著拉动美国投资，贡献 1.1 个百分点 GDP 增速，但大量设备自亚洲进口形成拖累， AI 带来的生产率提升预计2027年才会明显显现。二、行业轮动判断，不建议从资本开支板块转向消费板块，资本开支超级周期存在 AI 以外的多元支撑，主线逻辑不变。
Everyone, it is August 13, Thursday. Welcome to Morgan Stanley Asia Macro Webcast. My name is Crystal G, Asian EM Market Strategist. Before we start, please don't note that this event is for Morgan Stanley institutional clients and financial advisors only. It is not for member of the press. If you are not a member of the press, please log off and reach out separately.Please also note that this session and your questions may be recorded. Today, we have Brigitte Sibol, Senior Global Economist, Chetan Iyer, Chief Asia Economist, Jonathan Garner, Chief Asia Emerging Markets Equity Strategist, Lydia Ling, Greater China IT Services and Software Analyst. During this session, you can send us questions at any time from the Ask a Question text box. So first up, we have Brigitte with us on the line to share the Fed policy outlook post the week payrolls last week.And also the reaction function of the Fed right now. Over to you, Rajiv.
Hey, good morning, everyone. It's been a volatile market if you're a front-end rates trader for the past few months. The correlations between oil and rate expectations had been elevated, and I think they're starting to fade a little bit. Morgan Stanley's economics call has been fairly consistent, I would argue, for the past few months. We do not think the Fed needs to be hiking this year. Our argument rested primarily on the view that disinflation was in the pipeline because of something everyone had forgotten about, which is tariffs. Basically, the tariffs were adding about 70 basis points or 62 basis points to be specific. This was about 3 or 4 months ago, to U.S. core inflation. And our view was that we had passed peak tariff,and that you would start getting the disinflation from that tariff process particularly strongly in August, September, and October with a steeper decline by the end of the year. this is a little bit of what we've been seeing. But in addition to some of the tariff unwind, we've seen actually pretty soft core services inflation in the United States and pretty soft housing inflation in the United States. This is all kind of what we expected perhaps in Q4, but the prints have been a touch softer. For example, in June, the CPI print was negative. And in July, we had forecast the one we got yesterday, we had forecast 0.24 and we ended up with a little bit closer to 0.2. So this is all in core inflation, core CPI. And so I think the point is that the inflation threat is not really what the market, I think, feared. The market was concerned with much higher prints, and perhaps in speaking to clients, they were perhaps worried about reacceleration of inflation, given how strong growth had been. And our argument was that we're kind of in equity terms, a little bit of a Goldilocks land in the sense that, growth is probably going to be better in the second half of the year in the United States than it was in the first half of the year. And inflation is still probably going to move its way lower over the next few months, a lot of it because of, as I mentioned, tariffs passing peak, but also in general, some of the strong prints that we had earlier in the year, part of which were tied to oil, but not that much, but in general because of where we were in the economic cycle. And so I think the Fed is now in a dilemma because the inflation dynamic is not one that suggests that they need to hike. Similarly, non-farm payrolls, they've kind of, the three-month moving average have kind of come in really close to our estimated of 50,000 break-even. So we've been saying since our year-ahead outlook 9 months ago that the break-even rate, not to say that that was going to be the forecast for non-farm payrolls, but that the break-even rate for non-farms in the U.S. labor market was about 50,000. And if you take the three-month moving average, we're just below that 50,000 right now after the past couple NFPs. It's probably a little bit soft, and maybe it picks up later in the year. But the point is that you're not getting strong labor pressure from job creations, and you still see this no higher in the fire market. And so the Fed is in a position where their inflation forecasts are probably a touch too high. We'll see what we get at the dot plot on the September 18th meeting. And the growth forecasts are probably okay. And so in this environment, the data does not suggest that the Fed needs to be hiking interest rates. The question then becomes, if they're not hiking interest rates for the data, and you know, the market, the pricing came down down yesterday, but there's still this strong pressure in the market that there's a risk of a Fed hike, which seems to be why we're finding it difficult to hold market pricing below kind of a 40% probability, 35% probability of a hike in either September, October, or at the end of the year. And I think that the issue is that the lack of communication has raised new questions for the market, and the framing of inflation being above target for such a long time implies that perhaps the Fed is realigning their perception of what the kind of what we would describe the neutral rate is in the United States economy. And our U.S. team, our global team have both written about this, highlighting kind of where neutral rates could be, where Fed forecasts are forecasting or estimating the neutral rate. And I think this becomes a challenge because estimating the neutral rate in the United States, this is the rate at which the U.S. economy can run stably. And it's a kind of a theoretical rate more than a practical implementable rate. If the perception by the Fed of the neutral rate in the United States is higher than it had been before, then indeed, there's an argument that the Fed needs to raise interest rates. The challenge that I see is that in a world in which the Fed is not communicating their perception of what the neutral rate is, then the market will be continuing to question whether or not the Fed needs to be hiking, even though the data tells you something totally different. And this is where I think Jackson Hole becomes critically important. I think the Jackson Hole meeting is an opportunity for Chairman Warsh to at least anchor his view. It's one thing to not really communicate on a 6-weekly basis at the Fed meetings, but it's another thing not to have a framework. And I think Jackson Hole is an opportunity for him to perhaps communicate a little bit of his framework so that the market can then anchor a little bit more closely what the Fed's perception of neutral is. Now, Morgan Stanley has the view that the neutral rate is more towards 3 rather than 3.5 or a little bit higher. And that's why we had been anchoring into that lower rate, viewing that maybe in 1 year's time or 1.5 years' time, the Fed would be moving into this kind of quote-unquote neutral rate, but not having to be forced to do so during the 2026 year. So that's why we have no hikes or cuts in 2026, and then a little bit of an easing bias in 2027. Now, if our perception of what the Fed's neutral rate is wrong, or because ours is more anchored to what I would call the Powell era, if that has changed, then there's an argument that the Fed doesn't need to be doing anything for a long period of time. But this is, I think, a debate that will probably fill the airwaves more at the end of the year and into 2027. For now, we see the data, at least we think that the market needs to continue to unwind pricing in 2026 around rate hikes. But with that said, you know, we still have 2 more prints, one CPI, one NFP before the September meeting, going into that important meeting, but also the dot plot. And we have Jackson Hole. So there's a lot of catalysts still to play for the September meeting. We think the market has gone in the right direction, going from pricing almost certainty of a rate hike towards, I think we're about 1/3 probability at this point. But the volatility as a front end rates trader may continue. And I think equity market rotations have been reacting pretty strongly to these moves. And so I do think you have to be cognizant and carefully, keeping an eye on these data prints, particularly NFPs and CPIs, that will be coming out ahead of that September meeting. And then also Jackson Hole is, Friday, August 27th, when we will get the Chairman Warsh's speech. So that's another thing to keep an eye out for. Given that this is an Asian webcast, I'm also going to take a minute to talk about the BOJ intervention, where Bessent, U.S. Treasury Secretary, seems to have played a cooperating role in the yen intervention a few days ago. I think that there's been a lot of speculation and discussion. The currency has started to drift back a little bit higher after the initial
请关注公众号思维纪要社，更多纪要请加 VCN20210130。
In the initial move, you know, in general, our view is that these interventions historically have not stuck. So there's probably a bias towards a weaker yen here for the next few weeks, but it does not preclude that there could be more intervention. And so I think this is where the market needs to be on edge. Positioning when the intervene position had been very extreme. I think Scott Bessent leaned on his hedge fund background to time the intervention, or at least advise the Ministry of Finance. That's speculation, but he had, you know, in public press indicated his desire to intervene that had been circulating in the U.S. very strongly around the time of the intervention. And I think, you know, the more important framework for thinking about the currency on a structural basis rather than a technical basis around these interventions is the rate differential. And our view is that, you know, if the Fed's not hiking and the BOJ is hiking, that rate differential will slowly work its way to what I would describe as a more narrow and more sustainable level, which may help support the currency. But this is something that will take time. And so the volatility in the currency and the angst around speculation will probably continue. I will defer any discussion on the Japanese side and the BOJ side of the currency intervention to Chaitin, who is speaking after me. But just to say from the U.S. perspective, this is very much a Treasury decision. This is very much a Treasury process. This should not be a Fed process. There's been some questions around Fed lines to help with swaps and so forth. These are mechanical things, and I think it's important to highlight that the Fed's role in this in terms of execution of trades and in terms of crediting lines is very much a mechanical trader perspective, because remember, the Fed is the trader, so to speak. They're the execution desk for the Treasury, the New York Fed. So when you see the Fed being involved, it should be in the lens of an execution desk trader rather than a policy. And I just think that's important to highlight that we do not view this as affecting U.S. Federal Reserve policy. Let me stop there. It's been a little bit over 10 minutes, and hand it back to Crystal.
Thanks so much, Rajiv. And then let me invite Chaitlin here to share a bit more color on the BOJ intervention, and then your views there, and then also more importantly, the you also published a note on the recent recovery in non-tech, and then what sectors and economies do you want to highlight to investors?
Yeah, thanks, Crystal. Let me just pull my slides in. I'm going to take a few seconds to get that slide up. But before I get that up, the key story that we wanted to share today was on the topic of how is the non-AI, non-tech part of the economy doing in the region. There has been some volatility in the AI stocks, and therefore investors are quite keen to know whether there's any story beyond AI. So our message is that yes, the non-AI part of the economy is actually doing quite well. And we've identified three sets of indicators to watch there. Number one is on the exports front. And on the exports front, what we see is that the non-tech exports are growing quite well, almost across the board. The most important number that we're looking at is the aggregate non-tech export growth at about 17% year-on-year. And if we take on a sequential basis on how it is doing, it's even better. Since October 2024, the numbers are looking annualized 25%. Now that I have the slide up, let me just pull that page to show you the trend in the exports. So as you can see, on a year-on-year basis, it's around 17%, but on a sequential basis, it is 25% since October. October, because that's a time when Asia did a lot of deals with the U.S., Asian economies did a lot of deals with the U.S. And to calculate this non-AI, non-semi exports category, we did some granular work of looking at subcategories of exports. Because in the past, when we would just do excluding semiconductors, a lot of people were saying that non-semiconductor exports are also heavily influenced by AI. So we've taken out all lot of stuff which is related to AI, and then looked at the non-AI related exports numbers, and that's what is there in front of you. The second data point we were looking at is imports. And for imports as well, we did the same task of identifying capital goods imports, which are related to AI, and those that are not related to AI. You can see this chart here on the left-hand side, that it's quite broad-based improvement in the non-AI segment. In the past, when I have done this analysis, we had seen that consumer goods were lagging, but now we have seen that consumer goods have also started to do well. So this is now quite broad-based. Intermediate ex-fuels is essentially including materials, textiles, type of goods. So yeah, broad-based improvement in non-AI related capital goods imports, overall imports. Now, if you look at the CapEx story and the capital goods imports part of the story, We think that the question there also gets asked that, you know, if you have things like energy related capital goods imports, isn't that also linked to AI? So to establish that point, I've then broken up our forecast on CapEx into different sectors. And as you can see from this slide, it's, I should have done the full screen earlier. But if you see this slide on the, or rather the first column on the table, hyperscaler or the core AI CapEx in Asia is about $130 billion right now. And semiconductors CapEx is bigger, but that's for meeting the global demand. So if you were to think about impact on Asia energy demand, you have to look at hyperscalers CapEx. And then if you look at the energy CapEx number, that's in 2026 and the energy column, that's at $900 billion. So how can $130 billion hyperscaler CapEx drive $900 billion of energy CapEx? And to again clarify, in 2023, before AI really came into picture, Asia's energy CapEx was $740 billion. So this is quite a big component independent of AI. And again, to clarify from our energy analyst, the increase in energy CapEx that we're expecting, one could argue that that could have been also very heavily driven by AI. But we, in our numbers analysis, that indicates that about 30 to 35% of the increase in energy CapEx that's coming up over the next 4 years is coming from AI, and the balance is not related to AI. And then if you look at the other line items like defense, that's again not related to AI. And then we have a whole lot of industrial CapEx, which may be partly related to AI, but the numbers are just so big, as I discussed, you know, you cannot have a small CapEx line item of $130 billion driving $4 trillion of industrial CapEx. So that's an important point which I wanted to highlight because this is coming up in our client conversation a lot. Moving on to the third indicator, and that is the private consumption part of the story. So what has happened is that we have seen non-tech exports, which tend to be more labor intensive, doing well. We have seen pickup in non-tech area in terms of CapEx, which tends to be more job creating. And so therefore now we also have the evidence of labor markets doing well, and then that is translating into better consumption. So here on the left-hand side is the trend in Taiwan and Korea private consumption, and on the right-hand side is retail sales. Interestingly, even Japan, which had been lagging, you guys would have heard me speaking on this forum earlier, that Japan's private consumption is just about a percentage point higher than where it was in 2019. But if you just look at the trajectory at the margin, in the last 12 months, we've finally started to see a nice pickup in Japan's real consumption. That is because real wage growth has also turned positive. And similarly, in case of India, we've seen this turnaround in wage growth, and then we see very strong evidence of retail sales and auto sales doing well in India. So this is a broad-based story. The only part of the region which is not still showing clear strength on consumption is China. And our framework there is that as non-tech exports continue to do well, it's only been like 3 months that we've seen a proper pickup in non-tech exports in China. You should see an improvement in this non-commodity sector's margins that will then translate into better wage growth. And therefore, you should see some improvement in consumption in China as well with a lag. Having said that, China has structural issues like demographics and the property sector drag, which will mean that consumption in China will improve, but it's still not going to be coming back full throttle. So with that, let me stop here and hand it back to you, Crystal.
Thanks so much, Chetan. And then before we take any Q&A, let me move on to the next topic. And then welcome back, Jonathan, from all your travels. And then can you share your latest thoughts on the markets, including Japan versus yen, and then also on Korea, which we recently upgraded at the start of the month.
Yes, thanks very much, Crystal. Hello to everybody. So, yes, our view on markets is constructive generally after the correction in July. And yes, on the 2nd of August, together with Jinsook, we did upgrade Korea back to overweight. The other markets that we expect to perform well here continue to be Japan, as well as smaller markets, Singapore and Thailand. But the general story is one where earnings growth estimates continue to be firm and revisions breadth is positive, not uniformly. And in fact, as a segue from what Chetan was just saying in his closing remarks about China, we do have more pressure on earnings estimates in China, India, and Indonesia. But in large swathes of Asia, particularly those that are most geared to the CapEx supercycle that we've been writing about, both in the economics team and the strategy team this year, things are going well. So I will just now share one diagram from this morning's Pulse note on Korea. And hopefully you can all see that. So what you're looking at here is on the horizontal axis, consensus forward ROE, 12 months forward ROE, and on the vertical axis, evaluation metric forward price to books. Obviously that reconciles to forward PE. And the bubble size is the size of market cap, free float market cap. And the arrows are showing you what's been going on since the end of 2022, which was the trough of a cyclical downturn for markets. So I think there are a few points to highlight. Firstly, the majority of the arrows are pointing upwards and to the right. In other words, we have got higher forward ROE than we did 4 years or so ago. And justifiably, we've had multiple expansion. Now, obviously, in some cases, the slope of the arrows is steeper than in others. So the US, which is trading around 5x price to book for 24% forward ROE, a quite astonishing level of profitability, as Mike Wilson has been highlighting, that's got a very steep line. But on Korea, what is really striking is that the forward ROE is over 30% for the market as a whole. So this is MSCI Korea. And yet we've only, as of this morning, gone from 0.8 price to book to about 1.5. Now clearly, with our Kospi target of 9,000, we're not arguing for, you know, even 3x price to book for Korea, let alone 5x. But it does, I think, on this diagram highlight just how dramatic the improvement in profitability has been for Korea. And I guess where the investor debate is, which is obviously about the sustainability of ROE. And I think in the last few days, what's clearly happened is the debate has swung back with the hyperscaler numbers and what we've had from the neoclouds to the view that actually 2027 CapEx in AI is going to be higher than 2026. And of course, the Korean market is broader than just AI CapEx. It's got defense, industrial capital goods. It's got the Korea value up agenda. It's even got exposure to the energy dynamic that Chetan was just touching on. So, you know, clearly as this debate rages, you can get volatility around the valuations, but the valuations at the start of the month were astonishingly cheap. The most extreme situation I think I've seen in 30 years, where on a forward PE basis, Korea was trading only a little over 5x forward PE for a prospective 30% ROE 12 months forward, which was just suggested an extremely positive risk reward opportunity. Or to put another way, you needed to have an immediate collapse in earnings expectations to justify what had happened to Korea in July from an equity perspective. And of course, as we wrote about in the note, what happened to Korea in July had a lot to do with positioning. Margin, a classic margin unwind, a leveraged investor unwind, and relatively little to do with fundamentals. I just pick out a few other things. Japan continues to move upwards and to the right. So does Singapore, the blue dot on the left. India is stable, if not drifting downwards and to the left, which is not a very attractive place to be on the diagram. And China is also stable. So MSCI China on the red on the diagram is essentially hardly changed from where.
请关注公众号思维纪要社，更多纪要请加 VCN20210130.
Where it was at the end of 2022, though the weights in the index have rolled over profoundly, but there's no positive underlying trajectory here in ROE in those two large markets in Asia. And then finally, Taiwan. So Taiwan is sitting in the purple zone here, the purple circle, sort of almost inside the US. So it's obviously highly correlated with the US and happens to have roughly the same forward ROE and valuation as the US. So when we do get asked about, like, well, why, you know, why Korea rather than Taiwan, we certainly recommend a lot of Taiwan stocks bottom up. But it is really where in Korea where the investor debate is centered and where the opportunity that presented itself at the early August was so dramatically skewed to the upside. So I'll stop there, Crystal, and stop the share and pass back to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And then last but not least, we have Lydia with us online today to share their team thoughts on China LM and also impacts on industry. Over to you, Lydia.
Thank you, Crystal. Hi, everyone. Today, DeepSeek just launched its V4 Pro model, which is the right time for us to talk about our latest report on AI, the Chinese AI industry, the LLM. The title is Intelligence War Over the Price War. And that really captures our core message. So over the past year, one of the biggest investor concerns around the Chinese LLMs has been commoditization. And China has a large number of open weight models. The API prices are significantly below the US. And every few months, we see another model claiming similar performance at a lower cost, especially for DeepSeek. So the natural question is, does this ultimately become a price war where nobody makes money? And our view is increasingly no. We think the industry is actually moving in the opposite direction, from the price competition towards intelligence-driven monetization. And we see three important changes happening in the same time, at the same time. First, the pricing is becoming more rational. Second, the open-weight models are being monetized more aggressively. And third, the model sizes are getting much larger. All three, in our view, point towards better monetization and higher barriers to entry. So I will start with the pricing, because I think this is one of the most important or interesting changes. So historically, the Chinese LLMs have been extremely cheap relative to US models. But the prices actually have already been moving higher continuously throughout 2025 to 2026. And the price gap between the China and the US models is actually narrowing. And on August 8, DeepSeek announced a significant API price increase to be launched in the future. And we think that's particularly meaningful because DeepSeek has historically been the industry low price outlier. And in terms of the reasons behind DeepSeek's price raise, we think there are three potential ones. First, the strong demand for its V4 flash models probably gives DeepSeek more pricing power. And the second is we think model companies like DeepSeek needs to balance their market share gains with the gross margin because the frontier model training requires a lot of the capital. And third, greater adoption of domestic chipsets could potentially increase the inference cost. But the bigger takeaway is very simple. The price wars are probably not the sustainable competitive strategy in LLMs. And if you think about the competitive dynamics this way, if you already have a frontier model, it's relatively easy to create a smaller, cheaper version and compete in the mass market. But if you only have an average model, it's much harder to move up and build a frontier model. And maintaining the frontier intelligence requires continuous investment in training, compute, talent, and infrastructure. So if you aggressively cut the prices to gain the market share, you may sacrifice the gross margin. And that means less internally generated cash to fund the next model. And potentially a weaker technology position also makes external financing more difficult. So we don't think commercialization and AGI are separated objectives. Commercialization funds the intelligence, and intelligence drives monetization. And that's the flywheel we think investors should focus on. And the second major change is open weight monetization. So there is sometimes a misconception that open weight means free. Historically, that was closer to the truth because many Chinese models used very permissive MIT or Apache 2.0 licenses. A third party could download the model, deploy it, modify it, and commercialize it with relatively few restrictions. But that's beginning to change. Moonshot's K3, for example, uses a more restrictive license, where the large mass providers need a separate commercial agreement to redistribute the open weight K3 models. And Minimax has also moved from a non-commercial license on M2.7 to a commercial open weight license on M3 as well. So why does this matter for investors? Because it potentially expands the monetization model from 1P to 3P. Today, a model company may monetize primarily through API sales running on compute that it owns or rent. But with tighter licensing, the same company could increasingly monetize workloads running through the third-party CSPs and model aggregators via the revenue sharing mechanism. In other words, ARR is no longer necessarily capped by the model vendor's own compute capacity. And we also want to highlight open weight destroy compute. We also want to highlight that open weight don't destroy the compute demand. And the lower price and higher accessibility can stimulate much greater use, which is, everybody knows, the Jarvis paradox. And we therefore expect the open and proprietary models to coexist in an increasingly multi-model ecosystem, rather than one side completely replacing the other. And the third change, potentially the biggest one, is the model scale. So until the first half of this year, most Chinese open weight models were below 1 trillion total parameters. And that changed also very quickly. We see Kimi K3 launched at 2.8 trillion parameters, and Qwen 3.8 max is at 2.4 trillion. And our expectation is that 2 to 3 trillion parameters increasingly will become the frontier baseline in China in second half of this year. And the pipeline is already moving in that direction. Minimax plans their M3 Pro at roughly 3 trillion parameters in September. And JAI has its next generation GLM model expected in October, also will be the large parameter one. And Alibaba potentially has the Q14 in coming September as well. And there's also media reporting that ByteDance is exploring a model above 5 trillion parameters, and some are even saying 10 trillion. So this matters to investors because the bigger models means they're the higher barriers. You need more training capital and compute for training the bigger model. But that's only part of the story. You also need better inference efficiency, infrastructure optimization, architecture design, distributed systems engineering, and organizational execution capabilities. And you need the financing and the compute sourcing capability to keep doing this in every generation of the model. So contrary to the view that there are very limited barriers in foundation models, we think the move towards larger models could actually widen the moat and accelerate the industry consolidation. So at last, I want to spend a few minutes on two stocks that we covered directly. So first is JAI or Zhipu. The stock corrected sharply after Kimi K3 overtook GRM5.2 on benchmarks, effectively repricing the AI from China's number one position back to the tier one position. But we think investors are over-focusing on the point-in-time ranking. The more important question is whether Zhipu can sustain the flywheel of better models, stronger monetization, more funding and compute, and the better models again. And we think that flywheel is forming for Zhipu. GRM5.2 is globally competitive. The overseas compute access is improving through AWS and potentially other third-party platforms. And the recent $4 billion US dollar financing significantly strengthened its ability to reinvest. And its ARR already reached its previous $1 billion US dollar full-year target in the first half. And we now forecast $2 billion US dollar ARR for 2026. And we raise our price target to 1,700 Hong Kong dollars. And with the next large parameter GRM model in October being the key catalyst. On Minimax, the near-term setup is more execution dependent. M3 disappointed investors on coding, scale, and pricing, but we see it more as an architectural validation model ahead of the much more important 3 trillion parameter M3 Pro expected in September. We also think the market is underappreciating Minimax's multi-model exposure. Its H3, the video model, has performed strongly in the video generation area and could provide a second growth engine beyond the LLMs. While roughly $2 billion US dollar of planned financing should support the continued investment in the models and compute. So we maintain our $1 billion US dollar ARR forecast for Minimax. And we lower our price target to 900 Hong Kong dollars, but we reiterate overweight. I will stop here and turn it back to Crystal.
Thanks very much, Lydia. That's super clear. And then now we are moving on to the question Q&A section. So the first question is for Rajiv. Have you seen any evidence of AI adoption in terms of the impact on growth and also inflation in the U.S.?
Thanks, Crystal. In terms of inflation, I'll start with inflation first, then do growth second. For inflation, there's very limited evidence in CPI, but there's a lot of evidence in PPI. So producer price inflation, we are seeing a lot of pressures, particularly from the cost of chips. That is very, very visible early in the supply chain. So in the United States, producer price inflation is measured through stages of the supply chain, and early in the supply chain, you can see a lot of pressure, particularly from chips. But as you move further down the supply chain, you don't see that kind of pressure. And I think this is part of the reason why you've seen large companies in the United States that are exposed to hardware, highlighting the margin pressure that they're facing, because what we're seeing is that the consumer is not really able to absorb some of these increased costs. And so you're seeing, manufacturers, having to find other ways to manage some of the increased input costs. But I think the bigger issue in the United States on CPI relative to AI is that chips and hardware and some of the places that would be more obvious to see the increased costs are just a really small part of the U.S. consumer basket. In the United States, over 70% plus of consumption basket is in services. And then 30% is goods. And if you go within goods, less than 1 percentage point is exposed to specific computer hardware that have seen the price rises. And so it's just very de minimis pressure from AI in consumer prices right now. This is not to say it won't create problems in the future, but for right now, we're talking, single basis points. And if you recall, as I highlighted before, tariffs were contributing 62 to 65 basis points to U.S. core inflation. So in the context of tariffs starting, that's 60 plus basis points starting to unwind, 1 or 2 basis points of pressure from hardware is just really not going to move the needle. And this is what we've seen in the last 2 prints. And this is what we expect to continue to see for the rest of the year. It's just that the entire cost of this is small relative to the basket and hard to pass through. to a very sensitive consumer. In terms of growth, it's very visible. So AI is incredibly visible in growth. AI CapEx is a key driver of investment in the United States. I think the interesting and important distinction here, though, is that for 2026, our estimate is that AI CapEx is contributing 1 percentage point to U.S. growth, which is quite material. But actually, imports are subtracting 0.9% to U.S. growth, i.e. the U.S. is buying a lot of stuff, mostly from Asia, but they aren't necessarily converting that into productivity and non-manufacturing CapEx quite yet. We'll look for more of that in 2027. But yes, in terms of growth, AI is quite visible in the American growth landscape. I'll stop there, Crystal, and about you.
Thanks, Rajiv. There is another question for Gartner. So what's your current sector preferences? Because a lot of we have heard a lot of interest from, especially from the hedge fund communities, on broadening out or the contest sector. So what's your current view here?
Yeah, so our views have not changed. We changed things at the stock level, but at the sector level, they haven't changed all year. So we continue to be very oriented to the core Morgan Stanley research themes and to what I mentioned earlier on in my remarks, the preference for CapEx versus the consumer and goods versus services. So that does mean that we still like semis, memory, tech, hardware, industrials, capital goods, materials and energy, and we are still broadly negative on autos, consumer discretionary and staples, including e-commerce, on IT services, and on financials outside of the markets that we're overweight on. So we do like financials in Japan, Singapore, Korea, and Thailand. And more generally, you know, moving on from actually what Rajiv just said about PPI, we're skeptical about downstream industries in general. And so our views essentially have not changed. So broadening out, if it means rotation or the idea that at the market level one can rotate aggressively to China, India or Indonesia, we disagree with that. And we also ultimately disagree with broadening out in relation to any kind of switch from capital goods to the consumer. That said, I do think that it's important, as I mentioned in my initial remarks, to identify that CapEx is not just AI CapEx. There's a lot of different dimensions to play the CapEx supercycle. Thank you.
Right. Thanks so much, Jonathan. There's another question for Lydia online. So how do you expect BAT to benefit from wider adoption driven by more open weight models and then more Chinese models as well?
Yeah, of course, adopting more AI models internally could boost their operating efficiency. But we think more important thing is the hyperscalers, their cloud business will benefit from the increasing adoption of open weight Chinese models. Because for the model vendors themselves, they have limited compute and they're also limited or constrained their ARR upside. But they choose to work with the CSPs, the hyperscalers, to deploy their open-weight models onto the cloud. And the CSPs can redistribute those open-weight models to broader market, and they can share the revenue. So that actually benefits both sides, the CSPs and the model vendors as well. So the entire TAM can be expanded beyond the compute that those model vendors have. And in addition to that, from our talks to some of the enterprises in China is that they're also concerned about directly purchasing the APIs from model vendors because they're also worried that their data would be taken away by the model vendors. So working with CSPs now seems a much better choice so they can leave on their proprietary intellectual properties onto the CSP platforms, not directly go to the model vendors. So that will also benefit the CSP's revenue growth. So we are very bullish on the Chinese cloud players, especially for Alibaba. And we expect a revenue acceleration in terms of its cloud business. And we've also seen that is happening in in the US markets. The big US hyperscalers are all seeing this kind of like result re-rating through their accelerating cloud revenue growth.
Thanks so much, Lydia. In the interest of time, we'll conclude today's webcast here and answer remaining questions offline. Thanks so much for joining, and do reach out to me and the team if you have any other questions. Have a nice day and see you next week.